Jeff York of The Establishing Shot, I'm happy to have you back on the show, as I always am. But today we're going to talk about a movie that I did not like the first time I saw it 21 years ago. It's crazy to think how long it's been since Steven Soderbergh's Ocean's 11 came out in theaters. I only saw it the one time, and I did not like it. But I revisited it last night, in fact, because Warner Brothers has put the trilogy out on HD DVD, the HD Blu-ray 4K thing. I still can't. It's a mouthful. They need something more elegant for this product. I can't, you know. I watched it again, and I have a brand new appreciation for the movie that I'm excited to talk to you about. And also, we'll talk a little bit about Oceans 12 and 13, because those are also in the mix, and I've got some thoughts on those. But first of all, how you doing, Jeff?
Doing well. Good to see you, my friend. And happy to talk about this movie. I, 24 years ago or what it was, liked it. So I haven't changed much of my opinion on it since then, but it's one of those that I think, and if I dare say to put words in your mouth, good sir, it may look better the more we see other movies that can't even begin to touch this kind of thing in this modern era. So what maybe seemed like an overstuffed kind of, lying a little bit too much on star power and trickery and stuff like that, whenever you see something like that attempted today, it usually is a big bust. So, you know, you can look back at this one and go like, wow, I maybe didn't love it as much then, but now I really appreciate it because they can't even do a film like that anymore, you know?
Yeah, we will definitely circle back around to that. But first, I want to set the table. Have you seen the original Ocean's 11 from the 60s with Frank Sinatra and the Rat Pack?
I did. And I like that one, too. So maybe I walked into the remake willing to sort of give it a fair shake and, you know, sort of a positive open mind or whatever you would want to say if you're going into something like that with original source material already in existence. I did find that that Ocean's 11 with Sinatra et al. Was a little dated and seemed a little maybe, I don't want to say lazy, that's a little bit too easy, but it reminded me sort of where they went with the things like the Cannonball Run, where a lot of star power and a half-baked idea, and it kind of gets by on its charm and kind of the camaraderie of the participants having a good time laughing and joking and scratching with each other, where I found that the first, the plot was decent, and I think it had a lot of charm to it, but what I think they did shrewdly in the remake is, you know, we've all been through those kind of movies before, and caper movies used to be a big thing in the 60s and even early 70s of Hollywood. And this one was a decent entry into that. I mean, there's better ones from that era, certainly. But by 2001, when Soderbergh took it out, I think he realized that we have to make this more elaborate. And it's funny, honestly, and it I think the sort of zenith of caper movies in a way may very well be the Sting, in the sense that it's this long con and everything is about the con and who's who and who's what gets sort of rug pulled along the way. And of course, the Sting had one of the most surprising endings. Now, I don't know if a modern audience would see that coming today. When I was a kid and saw that, and I was a little kid, I thought it was the coolest thing ever. Like, oh, wow. But, you know, it stood up pretty well. I watched it last year on Amazon, I think it was, Prime. And it's sort of shocking how well made that was and how clever it was. And it's kind of easy going. You know, you don't feel the labor of it. So by 2001, I think they had their work cut out for them. And some of it was a little bit laborious, but a lot of it, I think, maybe as you assume now, is pretty charming and pretty well put together and clever. And I think in many respects, Soderbergh's work tends to look better with time because of all that he's put into it. And then the fact that he's holding the camera and shooting everything as he's directing to is ridiculous. But that's his want, and he does it very well.
Well, yeah, I'm a Soderbergh fan.
Me too.
I like that he works in different genres and in different, you know, he'll work high budget, mid budget, low budget. He did a lot of really cool like stuff with video back in the day.
That's right.
But there was some, I think the reason that I couldn't get into Ocean's 11 back then is because of another Steven Soderbergh film from 1998 called Out of Sight. Adapted from the Elmore Leonard novel, one of my favorite movies. And I revisited that, I think, a year or 2 years ago, and it still holds up. It's wonderful. both are George Clooney playing, you know, an ex-con who still wants to get back in the game and gets wrapped up in this kind of world of danger with these, you know, menacing people. And he's got a crew with him. That's not as big in Out of Sight as it was in Ocean's 11. But yeah, I love Out of Sight because of that Elmore Leonard writing, you know, that, that kind of fun.
It's sexy, his best, the best adaptation of his work, I think.
Well, I'm not as up on my Elmore Leonard as I should be, but I thought Get Shorty was pretty cool.
Very good. And I like Jackie Brown too, but I think Out of Sight just was so smart and tight. And, you know, Soderbergh made Jennifer Lopez into the movie actress that we wish she was. Instead, she wanted to be a rock star. But he kind of resurrected Clooney's career. And it's a really smart, tight script. And you know, great parts for actors and great dialogue that he wasn't that he and Scott Frank were smart enough to transpose from the Elmer Leonard novel directly. And but yeah, I agree with you. When you compare this one right after Out of Sight, it's not as good as Out of Sight. Still isn't, in my opinion. But 20 years distance, it looks pretty good, especially if you haven't seen Out of Sight the year before it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is like it, the comparisons between, you could almost do a double feature, and looking at it now through the lens of the distance of time, I can see, I can appreciate those differences. Ocean's 11 is very much the big, you know, kind of flashy studio version of Out of Sight. Now, Out of Sight was also a studio picture, but, you know, it was mostly set in Detroit. This is like hopping all around glamorous cities like, you know, Hollywood and Chicago and
Las Vegas, of course.
Vegas, I think Atlantic City. It's much more, it feels much bigger in scope. Plus you have like this glossy cast of movie stars, whereas I mean they became stars from 1998, but I mean, you know, Ving Rhames and Jennifer Lopez weren't, and Steve Zahn weren't setting the world on fire then.
That's right.
This 2001, you've got George Clooney, you've got Brad Pitt, Julia
Matt
Roberts,
Damon,
Matt Damon, Andy Garcia. Matt Damon is the most fascinating out of this because by the time we get to Ocean's 13, he is, you know, Matt Damon. Or as I'd say in Team America World Police, Matt Damon. But here he's like just a couple years out from Good Will Hunting. You know, he's still pretty, he looks like he's about 12 years old, and he's got a pretty minor part in this movie, which you don't expect. You know, you think you're going to go watch a Matt Damon movie. This is not, he is down in the ensemble, but you know, still very good. But yeah, what's this movie about? George Clooney plays Daniel Ocean, who gets out of a New Jersey prison for, he got busted one time, even though he was connected to a whole bunch of other kind of con jobs. He did 4 years in the clink. His wife, Tess, left him while that was going on. And he gets out and immediately sets to work on a huge scheme to take down three Las Vegas casinos, all connected by one vault that's 200 feet underground, protected by a cartoonish amount of multi-level security. And he finds his friend, his old friend Rusty, who is now living in Hollywood and teaching the who's who of the CW at the time, or the WG,
that's right,
I think it was back then, how to play poker for movies. And he's hating his life. And so he gets this chance to go on in on this big job. And they pull the gang together. The entire film pretty much is the setup for this heist, and then the execution of it in the last, you know, 20 minutes, half hour. I think that might have been one of my points of contention, is that it felt like it was all set up for something. Well, you're telling me how you're going to do something, and then you're going to do it, and it pretty much plays out like you thought it would. But watching it today, I realized that, you know, many things go wrong. There's sort of these fun little interpersonal dynamics, these rubs, like Tess comes back into Daniel Ocean's life, and she's the girlfriend of the guy that he's trying to rip off with his crew. So there's multi levels of different kind of personal vendetta and sweetness, because he wants her back and she doesn't want anything to do with him because she thinks he's a dirtbag. This movie just, it works, and it's got that Soderbergh thing of, it's zippy, it's got that great kind of like poppy, you know, 60s throwback music. The dialogue is really on point. Everybody in the cast is doing something different. If you don't like what Don Cheadle is doing with that weird British accent, you can hop on over to whatever Casey Affleck and Scott Conn are doing, these like rival. I don't think they're siblings, but they're, you know, bickering best worst enemies friends.
Right.
Or you've got Brad Pitt, you know, constantly eating or sucking on lollipops. Yeah. Or you've got George Clooney being suave. There's just so much to love about this film that I can't believe I didn't see it when I first saw it.
Well, I think when you first see a movie, and I think this is true of every movie, you're probably engaged mostly in the plot. I mean, we're kind of gauged to read stories and put story first, and even screenwriters and directors and anybody else. Story is key, story first. So you watch a movie, especially one like this, and you're like, wow, there's a lot of story here, and I've got to keep track of this. And like, who are these people, and how is this going to work? And they're thinking, this is going to happen? Well, I don't know. And it kind of challenges you to pay attention to every single second of the plot, because they're going to throw some things at you, which later on you're going to better remember, or else you're going to be really lost. And they want to pull the rug out from under you, just the way they do in a Sherlock Holmes story, where it's all there. Conan Doyle or Agatha Christie, for that matter, were very good writers, and they'd lay out all the clues for you, but you wouldn't see them. And sort of kind of a similar thing here in a way. So you're really immersed in this heavy story that I've got to stay awake and pay attention to. But I think once you go back and revisit it, you realize, okay, I kind of get that story. Now I can enjoy the rest of it. And that's the same of other movies. Then you get into how it's made and how it's shot and the performances. And, oh, I noticed this little musical cue comes in here. How clever that was, because I wasn't really paying attention to it the first go around because I was so worried about that story. But here's how the music enhances that part of the story. So I think there's a great thing about seeing movies a few times, because you see them differently, even though you've seen them and know sort of what's ostensibly what's coming. And I think this is one of those. When I first saw it, I was like, okay, I got to really pay attention. This is going to be like The Sting or all those caper movies, or even the one with Sinatra. And I want to see what they're doing. But as you revisit it, you just are really sort of taken by all the charm and all the extras that is in this film that you kind of are marveling at. Like, as you know, Soderbergh is shooting all this himself with a handheld camera and all this kind of stuff, and yet he doesn't make any of the performances seem to be lax, or you know, he is doing all the post and the editing. There's a lot of editing here. It's not just filming that is coming through very strongly. And you kind of marvel at how the hell did they put all this together? Not just in the story of like, how did they get this plot to all come together so ideally for this heist? But I think the movie itself becomes almost kind of a heist on us. Like, we watch it, we're seeing it all, and yet we're kind of bamboozled just as the bad guys are in the core story.
Well, yeah, I sometimes overly ambitious or creative editing can get on my nerves, but yeah, in the case of Ocean's 11, they do these cool little tricks. Like, there's one where they build this scale model of the bank vault, ostensibly to just practice the heist, because they have to get everything note perfect or else they're screwed. But there is one shot where the camera kind of zooms in on this model, the open model of the vault, and then you see someone walking into the actual vault itself. It like cuts between them, but right, you don't even notice the transition. I was tempted to go back and rewind, like, how did they do that? But I was watching with my wife and didn't want to be too much of a movie nerd. Like, let's go forward. Don't go back.
Honey. We're watching this together.
Right. but there's these kinds of little tricks that, mm-hmm, to your point, aren't just confined to the screenplay, but in how the movie is actually told. And I don't know if it originated from this film. I feel like I've seen it a bunch since watching Ocean's 11. Maybe you can help me out with. But the idea, and I'm not going to put on the spoiler banner, folks, because this movie is well known. It's almost a quarter century old. So, mm-hmm, you know. But the device where they have a surveillance camera feed, and then the bad guys, or the anti-heroes in this case, swap out the feed for, you know, just a blank shot of an elevator so you don't see that there are people coming down the hall or in the elevator.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is that an old cliche that's just done particularly well here, or is this something that Soderbergh invented and people have just ripped off in the last 20 years?
Well, I think there wasn't as much closed captioning back in those days, and there certainly wasn't as much of it in films enough to sort of be used as a plot point to surprise people. I mean, they used to do things like where, you know, we'll just, I remember in Speed, which was at least a decade earlier, they got it so they were running the footage over and over again. So it looks like Sandra Bullock is driving the bus for Dennis Hopper, the villain, to see. But meanwhile, they're actually getting everybody off the bus before he notices that the feed has been. But that's also a closed captioning bit where they've got the, you know, the sort of municipal cameras that are working to their advantage. But, you know, it was rare back then for Speed and for Ocean's 11. By now, it's almost become a cliche. I mean, it's every show, everything that has any kind of supervillain or clever heist of sorts, of even if it's not a particularly clever one, they would probably do something like that because they can. And, you know, we can manipulate it on your cell phone and your feed on your laptop or wherever it is. And I think also since like things like Paranormal Activity, we've all become, oh, video conscious. Now we have whole movies that are about you and me just talking on Facebook, and villains and murder is going on around us. And we no screenshot in it is anything but found footage, which that had such a time in the movies for a good 5 years. And now it's kind of on the wane, I think, maybe for permanent, because it didn't make them any good scary horror movies. And you can only do so much with people sitting at their computer while demons sneak up behind them. But yeah, I think this was one of the first guys, first films that did that. And God knows Soderbergh used it to his advantage in the subsequent sequels, particularly 13, at various places where, like, remember when in 13, when they're changing the faces, so Al Pacino can't see who the crew is who's been robbing him, and meanwhile Don Cheadle's trying to distract him as the Evel Knievel kind of character. So yeah, they do a lot of shenanigans with the closed caption stuff or live feeds that they're manipulating, et cetera, et cetera.
I just want to come clean. I don't remember what you're talking about, Ocean's 13. Oh, okay. The only thing I remember from that movie, was it was kind of a miracle, because I didn't like Ocean's 11 at the time. I hated Ocean's 12. I think that is kind of a universally panned middle entry that just felt like all the stars were having a great time, possibly ad-libbing the entire, you know, film, and it
showed. But we weren't.
Right.
Yeah.
But I went to Ocean's 13, I think, as like a double date or something, and I walked out, you know, on cloud 9 or cloud 13, because I really thought it was fun and cool. But the only thing I remember from that is the commercial where Matt Damon is wearing a giant prosthetic nose trying to drink out of a wine flute, and it's just not happening.
Yes, yes. And that was one of the broader sort of weird pieces of it, especially when he's trying to seduce Ellen Barkin with that nose, which is so weird. But yeah, 11 is a little more grounded, because, I mean, I think just the premise of how are you going to pull off this heist of three casinos, but of course you have the advantage of, well, it's all in one vault. Okay, but how do you get in vault? How do you get out of the vault? And, you know, they do a very good job of the surprise of that. I mean, I don't know how many people would really legitimately say they saw that coming and stuff, but, you know, it's well thought out. And I think one of the charms of the movie, and maybe even more so when you watch it in retrospect, Ian, is that, okay, so George Clooney is getting beat up in the room, and that seems to go on for half an hour of this very critical time where, you know, they're sneaking into the vault, and who can get in there and open it and get these other people in there. But, you know, even though you know that's happening, it's like, oh, that's pretty clever the way they did that. You know, this distraction over here. And for us, when we first saw it, it's like, wait a minute, how is this going to work? And then you see how they kind of pull it off, and that's a pretty good little magic trick, if you will. And I think in some respects, the Ocean's 11 movies, at least in retrospect, work the same way that when you know what a twist is, or you know that, oh, Bruce Willis is dead in Sixth Sense, or, you know, Norman Bates is pretending to be his mother in Psycho, or even if, you know, you ever watch those, the secrets of the magic world that they used to have on Fox, where they'd have the masked magician. I watched every one of those and could never figure it out. And then as soon as you see it, you go, well, of course, how did I miss that? But part of the charm is you kind of go, oh, of course, I'm such a buffoon. And we kind of like that. I think that's kind of the charm of this too, where you're like, oh, that was pretty clever how they did that. And I was kind of bamboozled as well.
Let me ask you this, because this is something that watching it last night, and maybe it's because it's 100% because I knew the twist. And again, folks, turn away. If you've gotten this far and you don't want to know anything about how the movie ends, what are you doing? when the SWAT team, you know, Andy Garcia's, you know, Benedict, he calls the SWAT team in because he realizes that there's a raid on his vault. There are people in there who shouldn't be in there.
Right.
And there's some kind of a tussle, and you hear the lead SWAT guy like barking orders like, oh, we got to light him up or we got to get out of here or something's going on.
Right, right.
Did you, the first time you saw it, if you can cast your mind back, did that sound like Brad Pitt doing a funny voice to you?
You know, it did a little bit, but I think at the same time, I didn't maybe wasn't as fully aware of it because I didn't really think that's what they were going to do. I kept thinking that they're going to go back to maybe that same closed circuit TV and screw things up. And to some degree they did, but I didn't see that. So I was probably more sort of distracted by the noise and the quick cuts and some of the things where they're walking out. I also think it's kind of funny because at that end, the camera takes a lot of time to show Julia Roberts and her reaction to sort of realizing that Terry Benedict, her boyfriend, doesn't care that much about her. He cares much more about the money, which he's got to care about the money because everybody is dependent upon that in the three casinos. And, you know, God knows if the mob is involved. And we're talking broken legs or, you know, he's wearing cement galoshes, as they used to say. There's a lot of time and put on her at the end. So I think I was wondering where she's in all this and her big reaction, because she's got kind of a climax too, where she realizes that she should go back to George Clooney. Not that we knew that it wasn't going to probably go that way, but it's very kind of clever. But they take their time on showing her kind of slow burn over realizing that her boyfriend's a shit.
And it's, you know, it's also a great contrast, I think, to a lot of the movies that we see today, as far as, you know, her character doesn't have a whole lot to do. And I could see someone watching Ocean's 11 thinking, oh, Julia Roberts, all she does is fall back in love with George Clooney, but, or, you know, fall for Andy Garcia, even though she can't, she's allegedly a very intelligent person who can't quite see what's going on.
Right.
I think just to combat that, I would say that she is, you know, a very smart career woman who's got a big heart that's been broken.
Right.
And so she kind of almost doesn't feel like she needs anybody at the end, but she chooses to go back with Danny. I think that's a very sweet moment. She's not, you know, a lot of the time, I'll take my favorite whipping boy movie of this season so far, The Fall Guy. And you look at what's going on with Emily Blunt's character. You compare that with Julia Roberts in Ocean's 11. I mean, this is almost a quarter century on, yet it feels like a character that would have to be evolved from into Tess, because it's so kind of offensive. Is like, really, this is what you think of women? And for also all the men in this movie, except for Scott Conn and Casey Affleck, who are the immature kind of comedy relief, they're all, you know, adults, and they talk like adults, and they're not like developmentally arrested man children. Even though it's a comedy about smart, suave, sexy, dangerous people. And I'm like, where have those movies gone, Jeff? Help me out.
No, you're right. In fact, it's one of my biggest complaints about movies is I think those kind of characters are absent from the screen. And that's another reason why I think we like this 20 years past is its work is dumbed down. And like the Ryan Gosling character of Colt Seavers in The Fall Guy isn't as smart as Lee Majors was in the TV show when he was playing a character who was supposed to be a little bit, you know, with his back against the wall. Like, you know, he's older and he's not as fit as he was, and he's kind of the butt of jokes all the time. And yet he's going to use his skill set to bring in the bounty hunter task that he's got or whatever else. But you're right here. They're, you know what? I tell you, it's funny you say that, Ian, because I just saw a movie on Turner Classic Movies a couple weeks ago, and it was called Trouble in Paradise. And I'd never seen it, though I had heard of it. And it was a film that was directed by Ernst Lubitsch, which, you know, he was one of the great comedy directors from the earlier of Hollywood. And it's about a gentleman thief, as they called him. And he's played by Herbert Marshall, who was one of these sort of erudite sort of men who everything sort of sounded like he should get into a dry martini, you know. And then he has not one, but two paramours who are in this. So one is a fellow con artist who's kind of a pickpocket, and she's played by Miriam Hopkins. And then they set their sights on this rich woman played by Kay Francis. And all these people were kind of big actors or stars in the 30s, but there is an elegance and a danger at the same time to it. And there is a sexiness to it. And you just look at that and say, like, if I was in Hollywood and I was a studio head or something, I would say, make me that again. Show me those kind of films, because to your very point about The Fall Guy, as much as we like Emily Blunt and she's a terrific actress and she can be very sexy, and same obviously with Ryan Gosling, they don't have much chemistry in it. I mean, Ryan Gosling has more chemistry with Emma Stone when they're just looking at each other and he's playing, you know, an 80s song that he doesn't want to play at the party and she's mocking him. You know, they have more sexual chemistry there than the entire movie of Fall Guy. And yet here in Trouble in Paradise, where they still couldn't show anything too much. This is pre-code. So there's one scene where Marion Hopkins sits on his lap and it's like, you know, that they do a cutaway to like the couch after they've like come out from the bedroom. It's like, oh, they started on the couch. But that kind of stuff is missing. And this movie, which is, I think, another reason why Soderbergh did it, is I think he saw this as an opportunity to bring these gentlemen thieves, if you will, back into the limelight and have fun with them and make a sexy, smart adult film, which it isn't dumbed down at the least. In fact, I think he's playing up to people's attention spans. Like, hey, from the get-go, you better start paying attention here, because there's going to be a trick or two that Brad Pitt reveals in his poker playing with the ding-a-ling poster boys from Young Hollywood that comes back in the last 10 minutes of it. And you go, oh, okay, great. I do think it's hilarious, too, that he's eating all the time, because the cliche is you never show people eating in movies, right? Like every time you see somebody sit down at a meal for dinner and there's 10 minutes around the scene, they're always like this. Oh, yeah, what's that? You never see them. Well, no, we're good. I guess we don't want to watch people eat. Brad Pitt, not this story. It's like, hey, Brad, we need you back on set here. But I'm having a snack here at the craft service. Bring it with you. You know,
that's almost the exact feeling I got in that last scene where he's going to pick up Clooney from jail. Yes. He's just standing there eating a burger or something. It looked like
an awful gyros or something. Like you could feel the dyspepsia building in his stomach, you know?
Right. But I don't remember the exact move, but he like got something, I think, on his finger, like some sauce or something. And just went wasn't, you know, very actorly. Hey, Brad, just roll. We need you on set. Roll. You mean like a hoagie? No.
There you go. But,
yeah.
A cinnamon roll. Wait a minute. Are we doing breakfast? What's the time frame here? I don't even know.
But there's so much to love about this movie and the idea of the movie star. It made me happy to finally appreciate a movie that I kind of dismissed for over 20 years, but sure. Also kind of sad, because I know you're excited about the summer movie season. It's been kind of hit or miss for me, because I hated Fall Guy, loved Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, skeptical about Furiosa. I'm seeing If tomorrow night. I don't know what that says. I feel like there's all these stars and all this promise and all this money going up on the screen, but I don't know if any of it's going to be memorable or meaningful. I mean, when this movie came out, I remember it being, I remember it being a hit. I remember a lot of people talking about it, and it warranted mm-hmm. two sequels. So mm-hmm. There's something there. But the thing that struck out most to me is, like The Fugitive, which we kind of talked about in the Fall Guy mm-hmm. episode, this movie was, hey, there's this IP. I don't think they really referred to it back then as.
Yeah, that's a like fairly new expression, I think. Maybe 10 right. years of the last 10 years or so. Intellectual right, but, property, as they call it.
Yes. But there's this IP from, you know, 30 years ago at that point. Let's bring back Ocean's 11, because we've got, you know, our modern day Rat Pack of George Clooney mm-hmm. and Brad Pitt and these other folks will make it, you know, cool and sexy. And technology has changed so much. Vegas has changed mm-hmm. so much. We can really do something. And that's the way you need to handle any kind of attempt to resurrect an old property. Do you have something to say about this older film mm-hmm. or book or TV mm-hmm. show, whatever, and how it relates to modern day, or can we put a spin on it rather right. than just with The Fall Guy? I'm sorry, I never watched the show, as was established in that episode, but when I found out from you fine folks on the panel that it was about a guy who was a stuntman by day and bounty hunter by night because he had to make money, I'm like, where the hell was that? I might have refused to watch the Fall Guy movie if I had known that was the premise, because it's so much better than anything that was on the screen.
Well, you raise a very good point, and I think it's another sort of phrase that has become popular in the last few years, but it applies here to this discussion and certainly applied to that one, and that is they've lost the plot. And, you know, you can look at whether it's politics or society or certain people seem to have lost the plot. I mean, you know, the speech that the kicker gave from the Kansas City Chiefs the other day, it's like, you've lost the plot if that's what you have to bring up at the commencement speech. I mean, you can have those opinions and say them. And I'm not saying he's necessarily a guy that needs to now be canceled and all this stuff or fired from the team. But it's like, that's not the plot of a commencement speech. You lost the plot. And the Fall Guy lost the plot. It's like, no, actually, the material that you're adapting is about this man who's aging, and stunt people tend to be young. And he found another way to do that and apply his craft to sort of this new profession. But same here. I mean, I think this one doesn't lose the plot. It's funny how much the plot stays at the foreground and keeps us interested. And even the way Tess is pulled into it is part of that, because she's wondering, why is Danny there? What's he doing? But he's also using her as a little bit of a distraction to get Terry Benedict off his game, because he's this sort of laser focused guy who should be noticing these mores, but then he's worried about her ex-boyfriend showing up and some of those kind of things. So he may have taken his eye off the ball or missed the plot or lost the plot, if you will. But that then allows Ocean's 11 to sort of swoop in, because they've got the plot under control and win the day with their heist. I also love one thing too, that is a nice nod to Julia Roberts, because I think in some respects, Ian, she has a little bit of the maybe one thankless role in the movie, because she doesn't get to really partake in the plot so much. And that's why I think they did that more of her in 12, which I think was weird too, because it also ended up being too self-conscious. Like, oh, she looks like Julia Roberts. Like, well, it never came up in 11, and now it feels very, very self-conscious. But she does not figure as much into it. And she's a little stern in it. I mean, she could have had a little more sort of fun with the banter, but she's not having as much fun in her part as the others. But then Soderbergh gives her this wonderful walkout at the end, where she gets off the elevator and she goes, you know, you, Terry, more than anyone should know that the cameras are everywhere, because he's probably put them in everywhere, you know. And then she's walking out and she's mad as hell, and Soderbergh just walks with her. It's one time he probably let go of the camera and gave it to the you know, the clapper to put on the the dolly, and it follows her out. And from starting out, she's kind of walking with determination and sort of stern, and gradually but surely over those 10 seconds, she becomes the smiling Julia Roberts that we love. And then she's kind of ready to, you know, okay, I think I actually am sort of back in love with Danny. but she has, I think, the toughest part in the film in a way, because she doesn't get to have as much fun as all those other people. And you can tell they're having fun without it being like we're not having fun with them. They're having a lot of fun, and we're having fun with them. In fact, to this very point, I think Steven Soderbergh, I don't know if Clooney thanked him when he did when he won his Oscar or at any other award shows he's been, but Soderbergh really kind of resurrected his whole je ne sais quoi with the 1-2 punch of Out of Sight in this. And he was on the cover of Time magazine, I think shortly after this, saying the last movie star. And in some respects, that's the role that Clooney's been playing since these movies, is, oh, you're a decent actor, sure, but you're also a movie star, and you play that real well, because there's not a lot of guys who can sort of play the Paul Newman, Robert Redford kind of, you know, that can Tony Curtis kind of role that usually just asks you to sort of show up and be charming and cool.
Lot to unpack there.
Sorry, I know that was a lot, wasn't it?
It's no, like, but
thanks, I'm just, Jeff. I'm that was too much. No, like this movie.
it wasn't. It was great, but I'm just like sitting there. I want to catch up with a lot of stuff that you said that kind of inspired me to talk about it. But okay, Clooney is the last movie star. I also want to talk about Tess, but Clooney. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, he is a movie star, but I don't think he gets quite enough credit. Every time I see him in a movie, there's something about something he does with his performance that surprises me. Mm-hmm. Like, you look at, From Dusk Till Dawn, mm-hmm. The scene where he walks into the hotel room and Tarantino, who's playing his, you know, psychopathic brother, Richie, he's just murdered a woman in the next room, and Clooney walks into that room and it holds on his face. You see very, like, half a second flashes of like blood on the walls, mm-hmm. but just watching what he's seeing register on his face and then him going back and kind of scolding his brother. That's probably on the page, but there's a lot of different ways you can play that. But Clooney, just like, there's something, I think he's got that movie star presence, but he does have that actor's, you know, spirit mm-hmm. that I don't think he gets quite enough credit for. And I'm kind of disappointed. He's often, you know, Lake Como Italy, living the good life. He pops up every once in a while to direct or be in a film, but I'm like, come back, George. He's not as ubiquitous as he was in the early 2000s.
And I think he's probably maybe heard you, Ian, on this. He's an avid listener, because the next thing he's going to be doing is they're doing a Broadway version of Good Night and Good Luck, and he's playing Murrow in this. And now he's old enough to play it. And I think that's interesting that he's going to take that role on. I'm sure they're going to streamline it, because the rest of that movie, when he first wrote and directed it and starred in it, was a more of an ensemble piece. But so, yeah, I think he's probably – he's won a bunch of awards now, and he's in his late 60s, so he's probably like, let me try some real acting. But to your very point, I think what you're pointing out in From Dusk Till Dawn is he surprises, because – he, I think, adds humanity to these characters that a lot of times don't necessarily have to have them, especially in a somewhat two-dimensional kind of horror, almost comedy film like From Dusk Till Dawn. But I mean, in the first half hour, that movie's fairly grounded in like, this is skeevy shit here, and these people are bad. And even though Clooney's bad and he threatens people with his gun and puts the gun right up to Harvey Keitel's face and Julia Lewis too, it's not really who he is. He's doing it a little bit with having to be this just to get what he wants, where we see who he really is in that scene where he realizes how depraved his brother is. Now, his brother is a fucked up mess, and he pays for it later, which is nice. But we root for Clooney for the rest of it, and I think it's because of that scene. I also think of all the actors who today could sort of take on the mantle of Bill Holden, one of my favorite actors of all time, Clooney may be that actor, and here's why. I think, like Holden, they both have these sort of all-American, you know, macho male kind of good looks, but they're also charming in that sort of James Garner way that he had it in his day as well. But they're also a little bit darker. Like William Holden played selfishness, whether it was in Stalag 17 or, you know, hey, he's willing to become the gigolo because what else has he got going in Sunset Boulevard, to, you know, some of his later works, like even SOB, where he's like, yeah, I'll embarrass Julie Andrews because it's going to save this picture, so let's see her boobs. or even Network, where he's going to bed with the woman he very despises because she's everything, as Albert Brooks says, everything you despise in this business. Now I'm mixing Network and broadcast news. It's not right. Wait a minute. What about Tess? Tess, isn't that the name of his girlfriend in Out of Sight? Anyway, yeah, see, Albert Brooks is in Out of Sight, too. Remember that? Without the he.
Oh, yeah, wore, that's right. He played the guy in the millionaire.
Oh, no, it was Midge. It was Midge. Midge, that's right. Nancy Allen was Midge. That's right. What about Midge? Anyway, but Clooney plays this a little bit dark. Like when he comes up to her and he's using her at kind of the – in the dining room or the bar, wherever it is, and then, you know, Terry Benedict walks in. I mean, he knows what he's doing, and it's a little nasty. You know, it's a little dark, like, wow, you're kind of using her again, even though you're trying to profess that you love her and want her back. And Holden played that a lot. And there's very few actors who can really do that, because the Gary Coopers, the John Waynes, the Jimmy Stewarts generally played very good, all, you know, sort of stalwart kinds of guys. And if they were dark, it was because of, you know, the rough-hewn West or something, you know, or because they had to survive in those terrible times. And that's what I like about him. I think he adds that darkness to it. He didn't think he probably should have won the Oscar for a supporting actor in Syriana. But what I liked about his performance in Syriana is he played it dark and mean. Like that scene where he sits down with Christopher Plummer and tells him what's going to happen, because he's got these CIA connections. And even though he's kind of gone rogue and all this stuff, he's formidable. And, you know, he's got that edge to him, which, as much as he's handsome and suave and wears a tux better than just about anybody, he's probably gone through many decades of not being cool in Hollywood and struggling to even make it. That's probably made him a little bit bitter, but he's able to work that drama, that angst, that danger into his work. And I think, like you said, in From Dusk Till Dawn, he turned it into regret.
You know, when you're comparing George Clooney to William Holden, now the only thing I want to see, probably in another maybe 5-6 years, because I think Holden, I don't think, was that old when he did The Wild Bunch, maybe. But I feel like Clooney needs a bit more gristle on him. I want to see George Clooney in a remake of The Wild Bunch.
Oh, that would be good.
Because I can just see him in that iconic, you know, opening scene line. Yes. If they move, kill him.
Yeah. But it's funny that you say that, because I mean, and again, we don't make this about Bill Holden, but since we both are fans, he aged rapidly because he was, you know, hard living and drinking and all that good stuff. But it worked for him because by the time he did the Wild Bunch and Network and some of those, he was the Blue Knight on television, which he won an Emmy for. He was playing, you know, an aging person who was dealing with getting older and being obsolete and the prejudices that come against people of a certain age or hair color and et cetera, et cetera. And he, I think, did some of his best work in the last 5 years of his career. And Clooney, I think, with him going to Broadway to do Good Night and Good Luck, I think he's saying, I've kind of played the matinee, I've kind of played the leading man, the big movie star. I've got probably 15, 20 years left if I'm healthy. Let's see what I can do and maybe play up the age a little bit, play up that darkness even more, play up my age and see where that takes me. I applaud that he's doing that. I'm with you that now's the right time to do it because he's done all that other stuff very well. And this is maybe as good and interesting, maybe his most interesting potential third act.
Well, I also hope that he doesn't, you know, no disrespect to, you know, Pacino or De Niro or, you know, Nicholson retired, but
right,
you know, when you get to that age where if you do show up in a movie, you're playing like a cartoon variation of yes, your right. worst persona.
Yes.
I hope that doesn't happen with Clooney. You know, I could see him becoming Henry Fonda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or, you know,
I agree.
Or Paul Newman. Yeah.
Yes. That would be a great thing that like whoever his director, mentor, agent, best friend could tell him. I agree with that. And, you know, it's funny. You also set up a perfect segue if you don't mind. But I think Pacino is very good when he's directed well. And I think he was very well directed in Ocean's 13. He's playing the villain and he's playing a pretty slick, nasty villain in it, but he doesn't overdo it. And I kept thinking, oh, he's going to do the devil's advocate stuff. You know, he's pretty charming in that movie. And then the last 10 minutes, it's like, go ahead, Al, just chew that scenery. And he's bellowing and his eyes are popping out of his skull. And it's like, you know, there's some good lines in there, like, look, but don't taste, touch, but don't. But then he overdoes all that. But in Ocean's 13, he's very good. Like, even at the end when he's been defeated and he's kind of, you know, kind of morose a little bit, and George Clooney kind of comes up, swagger his hand in his pocket. He's like, took a big hit tonight, didn't you? Oh, you don't know what I can do. I know people and all that. But he doesn't make too much of it. And it's a very controlled performance. I think his last great, great performance, maybe other than this one, which was a good supporting performance, he was fantastic in The Insider. And that was well after a lot of his bellowing days. And even as much as I loved him in Heat, he got a little bit bellowy in that. And Michael Mann let him go there. Maybe that works in some of those scenes. But yeah, that's the thing is you want Clooney to not be a trickster. You want him to truly approach it like Henry Fonda, playing these roles, doing some of the best work in his 60s and 70s, even though he had been a movie star in the 30s and 40s as a young man.
Yeah, I do want to go back to the character of Tess.
Sure.
You're right. It's not exactly a thankless role, but it's a bit more buttoned up. She's not as having as much fun as the guys.
Right.
But I would say, I don't think that's a criticism from my perspective. I agree right. with you, but she is the woman whose husband was, you know, she was clearly in love with him because she stuck right. with him until right. he got caught and went to jail. I mean, you could do a whole mini series about their relationship yes. beforehand. Like,
right.
as was mentioned during his parole hearing, like he'd been connected to a whole mm-hmm. bunch of other skeezy shit, but he'd never mm-hmm. been caught except for the one time.
Right.
So she couldn't hack it being the wife of a felon who was, you know, in jail. So she divorced him. And she moved on and she found a guy that she loved. She's got her own career. I'm not sure if she was like an art curator or what exactly she did, but I got the feeling that's kind of what her deal was.
Right.
But she was a professional woman. She had her heart broken and she was trying to move on with her life. And then this jackass gets out of jail and he shows up and immediately implicates her in another one of his schemes. So she's rightfully kind of
right.
dismissive, but she also hadn't seen him in, you know, 4 or 5 years. And, mm-hmm. you know, George Clooney's got that charm. So mm-hmm. those conflicted feelings there. Mm-hmm. She understands that he and his yahoos could be doing something that are going to get them sent all right back to the clink and they're never getting out. So she's got to kind of protect herself. And right. even though she's got maybe 25 minutes of screen time because she doesn't enter the picture until like halfway through and she's kind of right. a plot twist.
Right.
I think she makes the most out of what the screenplay has to give her. And I think even though it's subtle, it kind of gives her a lot.
It does. And that's a great point. And in fact, Some people at the time, I remember, criticized her as like, why isn't Julie Roberts smile? You know, it's almost like that cliche that women hate now when you say you ought to smile more. That kind of BS. But the fact is, in order for the stakes to work, like, there is some really thing going on. He can go back to jail and this can be fucked up. And, you know, Andy Garcia plays it pretty straight too, though there's a glint in his eye that, you know, he's having fun playing the bad guy, but he is a formidable bad guy here, as was Pacino in the third one. You have to play it kind of straight and a little bit with gravitas like Roberts does. Otherwise it would be too frothy. And there would be like, well, of course they're going to fix this. They're going to make it all work out. We have to know we have to have a little bit of doubt in our minds as moviegoers to be taken along with this, because if it's not in question, then it just becomes, sort of a Valentine to old time movies. And even like in the movie that I was talking about, Trouble in Paradise, the twist there, even though it's lighter than air and it's kind of frothy in the ways that this isn't, is that the gentleman thief falls for his mark. So then it's like, which one's he going to take? You know, so there are a little bit of stakes, even though, you know, he's going to probably walk away with it with one of them in tow. But, you know, somebody's going to get hurt. But here, you know, she had to be kind of, yeah, you screwed me over and I don't want to go to jail. I don't want to be part of this. And if he doesn't do it right, he could get in jail too, or maybe worse, depending on, Andy Garcia's connections to whomever in Vegas. And we know if you're running a casino in Vegas, you probably have some pretty questionable best friends and colleagues. So,
well, and that's another thing that this movie had going against it when I first saw it, because we were only 6 years out from Scorsese's Casino, which I think did a great job of like, here's how Vegas works and the ins and outs and the kind of shady characters. You know, at the time, and you know, I guess it's been true the entire time this movie's been around, but I've been in different jobs. I work in the casino gaming industry. Mm-hmm. So there are a few shots, particularly early on when Terry Benedict is going through the casino and they're kind of narrating how he goes about his day. You pass all these slot machines, and most of them were ones that my company was working on at the time.
Oh, I love that. That's fantastic.
It was like, it was kind of fun. And now seeing it now, like, oh, that's right, that game was 25 years old. There's a lot going on here, and I think a lot to recommend. The one thing I want to circle back on, and it's the unlikeliest talking point, but I can't let it go. the thing about losing the plot, and you're talking about that guy, I can't remember his name because I'm not into sports ball, but the football player gave the commencement address.
Oh, right. Yeah, I'm blanking his name. Sorry. Yes. Maybe I've intentionally forgotten. I'll look it up for us. Go ahead.
I agree and I disagree.
Okay.
I agree in that, you know, there's a time and a place, and maybe that's not the place. Disagree in that what he was talking about was his projection of, you know, family values and how to live your life, you know, kind of right. He was giving that speech at a Catholic university, which, you know, is kind of, that's kind of what they're all about, right? And he got very emotional. It wasn't, I don't know if you watched the whole thing.
I did. Yeah, Harrison Butker, that's his name. Sorry.
Butker, yeah. Mm-hmm. He did get very emotional talking about his wife and how they met in, like, you know, band class or something. So they are literal, like, school childhood sweethearts. Mm-hmm. So I think it was kind of an aspirational speech about, like, there is value to, you know, finding someone and staying together for life. But I understand where you're coming from, and I would say that the people who are outraged at this guy need to point the fingers back at them and say, well, what about all your little Oscar speeches where people get up there and give a very progressive liberal message and everyone applauds, like, oh, this is so heroic and brave. Yeah. But someone dares to stand up for a conservative value and it's like, oh, this is terrible. We got to cancel, kick them off the Kansas City Chiefs. I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm off my soapbox. That's all I'm saying.
No, I don't disagree that there's too much finger pointing and too much wanting to cancel. I mean, I think if I was like even like a PR person or his agent, I'm not sure that that was probably going to help him in some regards. Even though probably doesn't need help as a player and a champion and all that kind of good stuff, but. I think it's an opportunity to say more positive things. And even if you want to say that, he could have probably said it in a way that would have gotten his point across without necessarily putting down somebody else. But I also think that people who say those speeches at the Oscars, I can pick those apart too and not like them either. But I think the overreaction is to your very, very conclusion is that, you know, this goes on a lot and sometimes it's chafes your hiney and sometimes you may say, yeah, I agree with that. And but for me, and I'm a little bit different politically on some aspects, of course, than as we've talked about, but I wince at all of it a little bit more and more. Cause I mean, there's so much you can say when you win an Oscar, you don't need to make it about, you know, something that's a bigger thing, especially when that isn't your job. And it isn't certainly the answer to what you have to say about getting an award for a film, unless you're talking about maybe the character in the movie that led to something, which I'm not so sure is even necessary as well. But at least there, you could at least understand it. If somebody was going to give a speech about, you know, television when they went for a network and like, we have to be careful, folks, you know, right. Not everything can be entertained. But I mean, Patty Chayefsky was the one who stood up there and said, you know, he was mad that Vanessa Redgrave and people were always using the Oscars as these political sort of forums. And, you know, it's not the time or place. And he said a simple thank you would have sufficed when she didn't have to say some of the other things she said. I agree with that. I think that there's a time and place for stuff. And I think it's a little bit egregious to use it and say, oh, now I've got this thing. I'm just going to use it for that. And aren't I self-important? But anyway, to the bigger picture is, I think a lot of movies, I think a lot of people, I think because everything is sort of this open, weird, anything goes world, we do lose the plot. But, you know, to your very point about the Fall Guy, which is where the real thing is, like, that's not even the story of that. It was more akin to the movie Hooper. Have you ever seen Hooper with Burt Reynolds, where he plays an aging stuntman and he's trying to figure out how to sort of navigate through the new movie and stuff like that? And that was all about the movie making and thing. That was more like that than this supposed homage to the intellectual property that was the Fall Guy. But anyway, can I say just one thing too? I
of course.
Whether it's Casino or this, I also marvel at filmmakers like Scorsese and Soderbergh who can go into these places and create the casino as a character too. There's so much where there's hundreds of people in the background and you've got all these things going on, the cameras moved around this, and that shit ain't easy. I mean, I've watched it firsthand in some things, and you know, okay, you guys just chatter there in the background and you'll see actors going like this.
Yeah.
And you know, yeah, you can cast better people for these things, but you know, you don't even notice it. It just all seems like you look at it and go like, did they film this during a real casino? Did they somehow sneak the cameras in there? No, that's all closed down. And those are hundreds of extras in there, whether it's Casino or the Ocean's 11 movies. It's just kind of impressive as hell, let alone all the other stuff that these directors are accomplishing with performance and storytelling, et cetera, et cetera.
I never thought about this until you just brought it up, but I know in scenes where there's like a school prom or a rock concert, the behind the scenes footage is all these people dancing awkwardly. There's no music. They're just,
I know, isn't like that terrible? Can you imagine having to do that? That would be so weird.
Yeah, but I'm just wondering if it's the same in the casino. Like, do they add all that, you know, diegetic sound in?
I think so.
Later, mm-hmm. So-called diegetic sound, because otherwise it would be filmed like, never mind.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, do they add all that stuff in as atmosphere, and really it is just a bunch of people kind of standing around like, yay, I wanted a slot machine, or I'm playing poker, you know.
But those are great questions. I imagine it's a little bit of both in some respects here, because I'm sure they want local noise, or, you know, make it sound like they're in situation where there is some of that that comes in, whether Bernie Mac is, you know, running the table or Matt Damon is placing a bet at it. But yeah, I'll bet most of that is probably added in afterwards, and maybe it's just them going through it because they want the sound to be perfect in front and they can figure that in the mix. But I know, see, that's the other thing too, is that so many filmmakers don't get credit for that, and they do that extremely well. But Scorsese and Soderbergh are very much expert at doing the crowd stuff too.
I want to thank you for reminding me, because I did want to bring him up. Bernie Mac, you know, gone too soon. Excellent in this movie. And his scene with Matt Damon, where Matt Damon is playing the fake Nevada Gaming Commission inspector, and he mistakenly refers to Bernie Mac as being colored. I'm like, oh my God. I thought, I couldn't believe it. And there's the reactions between those two. It felt like it was it didn't feel like it was scripted. It felt almost like Soderbergh was like,
Matt,
I want you to say the craziest thing you can. And then, but watch out.
It's so funny. Well, and I love the fact too, that, you know, there's a little bit of a chance for everybody to sign here, and they do the famous sort of curtain call, if you will, where they're in front of the big fountain and stuff. And, you know, each of them gets kind of their moment there. As you watch them, it's like each one of those characters came through pretty well. And that's a big cast. And then you also have the villain character and some outside things. And then Julia Roberts. I also think it's got one of the funniest curtain lines, isn't it? Well, not curtain lines, but one of the last lines in the scene where it sounds again like an ad lib, but Clooney walks up to Brad Pitt and goes, Ted Nugent called. He wants his shirt back or something. Doesn't he say that? Oh, my God. It's hilarious. It's like, and I remember thinking at the time, just for a split second, I was trying to figure out what he was eating and what he was wearing. And then it's part of the, like, okay, I give you shit all the time about your wardrobe. I've been in the clink for another year, and I'm going to get right back into it. It's very funny.
Yeah, it's, you can't buy that kind of banter or chemistry, because there's a reason that all these people were movie stars. They are magnetic. You don't want to stop looking at them. And even some of the lesser known actors who are part of the crew, they almost get some of that secondhand wattage just by being in the same vicinity and part of the same plot.
Right. So true. Elliot Gould is terrific in this film. I mean, he's very, I think he's one of those great underappreciated actors, really, considering he started out so hot in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, then he had some, you know, weight issues and got older and, you know, kind of was resurrected a little bit by Friends by being the Geller's, you know, patriarch. But he's good in all these movies, and particularly in this one where, you know, he's playing very outside of himself here. You know, he's got the bad bowl cut, and, you know, he's like, oh, I'm, you know, just kind of what's going on. It's very funny.
Yeah, he's like, everybody in this film is on point, and they're doing something different, except for, I mean, again, why did Don Cheadle have to be a British dude? Just let him be Don Cheadle. I was so distracted because I felt like he was working more on the accent and not doing enough with his character. Like, I've seen him do character work in other films. It's really brilliant. Here, I'm just like, yeah, it's nice to see he's part of the team, I guess.
He probably felt like, oh, let me do something else because I don't want to just be one of the two black guys in it, and I'll do a character that's outside of me, so that's unexpected or something. But, you know, I just want to say one last thing too about Soderbergh with his direction and, you know, his camera work and all that kind of stuff. But in addition to the wonderful long shot that he gives sort of Julia Roberts as sort of her last fitting moment, even though she's in the back of the car outside the prison, I love the way he ends on Terry Benedict, where he's just kind of sulking, like he knows he lost the money, he knows he's lost the girl, and he gets into the elevator, and he's brooding, and he turns around right into the center, like I am here, and he's like, and the door just closes, and I'm like, you're end of scene, you know, and chapter and verse, book closes. That's such a great shot. But Soderbergh thought that out. I was like, you know, it'd be funny if I just, like, almost close it on him. A little variation of Diane Keaton, get that door slammed in her face in the end of The Godfather.
Thank you. I was thinking that exact same thing.
You're done. The only thing,
oh, it's so sad.
Oh, my God. And that's the last shot of the film. It's her. You know, she's the one last untouched sort of good person. Or touched, but, you know, still remaining good. Because Michael started out that way, and look at his arc in that film. Jesus.
I know, it's Diane Keaton's face, you know, when it's, but no, the only thing I think that could have made that ending better, and it goes to something you had talked about earlier, which is, you know, it's Vegas, the assumption, no proof, is that it's all mobbed up. So Terry Benedict does not come off across as a mafioso, but more as like he's the guy who is there to make sure that all the properties and the money run smoothly.
Right.
I would have loved for him to have been in his office and all of a sudden, like, a dozen different phones start to ring because people have gotten wind of it. And it's just like him, he's as cool as a cucumber guy throughout the entire movie. Then you just like see him start to sweat I'm not saying he needs to like go ocean or anything like that, but just a little bit of sweat would have been fun.
Yeah. Terry, there's a call for you on line 8. Line 8, we don't really get many calls on line 8. And you know who line 8 is.
it's Joe Pesci. No, I think the other thing I didn't remember, because I think I blacked the movie out of my memory, at the end, it's kind of a light ending, but then you notice the two heavies are
still following them.
Our yeah. trio. I'm like,
they're watching
that's
him.
Borderline dark. It's not played for laughs. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, these are the two idiot, you know.
Yeah, he's not quite out of the woods. He's chosen this life, and it kind of goes on.
Yeah.
The good and the bad.
Wait, but we've already talked about Ocean's 12 a bit. You know, this movie was so good that I feel like I need to go back and give Ocean's 12 another chance to see if it was as bad as I remember it being. But I remember it being like excruciating to get through. And this is like a $5 Tuesday. One of the bunch of friends is a game audience, is, you know, huge crowd in the theater. But I remember it being pretty quiet. Like there weren't a lot of laughs. There was a lot of like shuffling around in seats. But Ocean's 13, I remember being a very fun experience, like a Saturday night at the Woodfield Mall. I just bought spiffy leather jacket, and I was feeling very, you know, pumped to see a movie. And even if I didn't have confidence in it, but like I said, I walked out feeling I was on cloud nine. So yeah, that's Ocean's 11 and bits of 12 and 13. And Jeff, I really appreciate talking with me. And as we do every time we talk, you rattle off half a dozen films that I'm embarrassed to say that I have not seen that we're going to have to talk about in the future.
Please call.
I've never seen The Sting.
Oh, wow, Ian. That's
I know.
I think you can watch that. Like I said, I think that might be on Prime or maybe even Netflix. I'm sure you can find it, though. It's it's kind of an homage to the 30s, obviously. Very fun. Made by George Roy Hill, who did, of course, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and he reteamed Redford and Newman. And I think it got kind of lost for a while in the wake of talking about the history of films. But as people come back to it, maybe to your very point of doing this podcast, because they just don't make them like that anymore, even though that was kind of a nod to the 30s. It's like, wow, a good caper film. Those are rare. And this is one of them. Sting was one of them too. So I think you'll like it. It's very well put together, very clever, and some fun rug pulls in. A lot of little ones throughout the movie. It's not just like, oh, you know, like you're watching a movie like, you know, M. Night Shyamalan stuff, and it's like, oh, there's all this for this one big rug pull. There's little rug pulls all the way through it until there's a much bigger rug pull at the very end. Also, I will say this. If you're a Robert Shaw fan, it might be his best screen performance other than Jaws, and he's great in it.
I am a Robert Shaw.
Yeah, he is fantastic in it. In fact, at the time, I'll tell you this. People thought he was going to get the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, but his agent convinced him to campaign as a lead because he's got a very large role in it, but he didn't, and he ended up in the wrong category. But he didn't get nominated in either category because I think they didn't know. Well, he's not really the lead, is he? But Redford got the nomination, but Shaw is great in it, and he's very menacing and kind of funny in his way too.
What year was The Sting?
73. Okay. Yeah. The big film that everybody thought might win was The Exorcist. That was the movie that everybody was talking about. But it was ultimately, I think, too genre, too horror, too whatever about it. But The Sting was kind of a gobsmacker because it was very clever. A lot of star power. These guys at the height of their thing. And kind of modern, but also a throwback. And you just kind of looked at this and went, how did they pull that off? It was very clever and a huge hit. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that in those days, a lot of times the critical hits that also made money were easy picks. Were like The Exorcist. My God, are we going to vote for that movie where the woman, the young girl has the crucifix? Maybe we'll give it a couple Oscars, but I don't know if that really had a shot at the big prize.
Well, I got to watch The Sting. I got to watch Hooper, and I got to talk to you about all these. So yeah, expect some calls in the next couple months. So
I would love that.
But Jeff York, again, of The Establishing Shot, thanks so much for hanging out. Those out there, if you want to watch Ocean's 11 and see it as you've never seen it before in stunning 4K, again, it's out the entire trilogy in one set. Well, they do the flipper thing, which is kind of annoying as far as the discs and all that stuff.
Yeah, they still haven't figured out that part of the packaging, have they? Like, no. How do we get this condensed without being irritating?
I much prefer the slim cases. Remember those?
Yeah.
Anyway, you can find it wherever you get your movies, which is not Best Buy. I don't know if you knew this, Jeff. I found out last year that Best Buy announced they were going to stop selling movies. I thought they just meant at the store. They don't even have them online. You can't buy physical discs anymore.
Less and less places to get them. That's for sure.
It's a crime.
Wow.
No. All right. Well, I'm going to stop rambling about movies, which is an odd thing to say, and I'll let you go. But thank you very much, folks out there. Check out Jeff's stuff down below. And if you like this this show, please like, subscribe, and all that business. And until next time, whenever that is, whatever that is, thanks very much and take care.